Welcome to episode number 4 of the Subsidiarity Podcast, a liberty-oriented discussion of current events and topics of interest. Today is Sunday, the 9th of September, 2012. My name is Ashley Johnson, and I blog at libertypei.blogspot.ca from Charlottetown, Prince Edward Island, and my co-host...
Hello, I'm Dave Killian from Vancouver Island, where I blog at libertarianbookclub.com. Today,
I have a article from The Guardian, theguardian.pe.ca. This is titled, Province to Hike Daycare Rates. So we'll read from the top. Daycare rates are going up next month at provincial early year centers across PEI. This means parents of infants up to 24 months will now pay $33 a day for childcare. Toddlers 24 to 36 months will cost $27 per day, and those with preschoolers over 36 months of age will pay $26 a day for daycare. So the unquote. So the state here is exercising their right to control prices, and they are adjusting them upwards to the dissatisfaction of the electorate. So even just reading at the comments here. Most of the feedback seems to be not so much an ideological reaction, but a political reaction. They seem to be saying that the Liberals have not been spending very wisely, and the taxes and fees and now daycare are coming to a head, and they're not happy. I think they might be paying for it in the next election, but this is not about politics, so what's your take on it?
When I took a look at it, of course, the first thing I was interested in was whether or not BC had a similar sort of program, a subsidized daycare. And I can't recall from memory, as I think I might have mentioned to you before, my children are all grown, and my wife was a stay-at-home mother. So we weren't involved with daycare, nor were any of our friends. But I understand from this article that daycare in PEI is a provincial matter. And so this is that's a bad practice for PEI right away, because it adds it means that being a provincial program, it makes PEI somewhat less competitive with any province that doesn't have a subsidized daycare program. You're going to some kind of back and forth about that. People are going to say, well, this makes PEI more attractive for young families and so on, but that's really not the way it works out. It's fine kind of on the upfront, but you get this sort of forgotten man syndrome going on there, where you don't recognize the businesses that don't come to PEI because they face this plethora of laws and regulations and subsidies that makes Prince Edward Island less competitive. The big quote from the article, of course, that blows by, this sort of euphemism blows by people all the time, but libertarians pick up on it in every article you read. The quote is, Education Minister Alan MacIsaac said this increase in rates is due to the wage increases for workers this year. MacIsaac says, they're due for a wage increase, and that's where it's triggered right now, and that dollar we're asking to come from the parent side. Of course, you know what word is jumping out to me in that quote, I'll bet. And that word is asking, because, of course, the government's not asking for anything.
He's also looking at the word due for a wage increase. So these geniuses and angels know exactly who should be paid what.
I think the due is a contractual matter. It's something that's built into the legislation. So that I didn't take that to be MacIsaac saying, well, it's about time they had a wage increase. I think that's something that's actually built into the legislation governing this.
Okay.
But the whole problem here arises from candidates attempting to farm votes, or candidates and existing elected officials. They're attempting to farm votes. And they do this by promising everything to everyone. And unless you're paying attention, you don't see that they're writing checks with their mouth that our pocketbooks can't keep. They're promising one group cheap daycare. They're promising another group higher wages. And of course, if you go into the comment section of this article, you see the problem is, of course, that the wrong party's in power.
Yeah.
That's the whole problem here. If you would just take these current meanies, these stingy, black-hearted people and replace them with the sweet, good-hearted, open-handed folks in the opposition, then they will raise the wages of daycare providers without taking any more money from parents or taxpayers.
I would guess that there are some people in the comments there who are at least reasonable enough to say that they don't actually want good people in office so much as they want their people in office who will take money from other people. Not me. Like the daycare people need to get paid more, but not from my pocketbook, my neighbor's pocketbook.
Another thing you'll find in there is people arguing things to the nature of anyone opposing subsidized daycare obviously hates families or thinks only rich people should have children. You know, if you this is your position. If you're not in favor of subsidized daycare, you're in favor of some kind of eugenics program which denies poor people children. But my understanding is there's been an awful lot of children born in this world who came up without the benefit of subsidized daycare. But if a candidate promises you that he can do anything good outside of cutting taxes and cutting spending, then that candidate is either a dupe or he's trying to dupe you.
That sounds like it might even be repeating. So any candidate can only do one of two good things for anybody, which is, well, they're both two sides of the same coin of leaving you alone, leaving your money alone and letting you do what you want with your business and anything else.
That's right. Anything else that they attempt to do is going to go awry, and I'll explain more on that when we talk later on. We've got another topic on later on where I'm going to speak a little bit about why governments are unable to value things incorrectly, and then they wind up. It's not to say the state doesn't do anything good. There are some people who benefit from things, and subsidized daycare is probably, you know, it's probably okay daycare, and there aren't many kids being hurt. But even if it's done well, it's probably still not priced properly. As I said, we'll touch on that later on. But yeah, certainly, if they think any politician who says he can provide cheap daycare for you while providing good wages for the daycare providers is, as I said, either a dupe or he's trying to trick you.
So you want to put this in context of the fatal conceit again?
It'll come up. It's not just the fatal conceit, because the fatal conceit only speaks to half of it. But Hayek's view that the fatal conceit comes from the central planners believing they can aggregate all the information they need to in order to design a system that performs optimally is also compounded by, it's not just the knowledge problem, it's the incentive problem, which is that you have people, politicians and bureaucrats, who are spending money that isn't theirs on people that aren't really important to them. I'll just leave that to simmer until we get to the other topic.
Sure, sounds good. So I think it is probably also worth noting that this is not a complete price fix. So in my ramblings on forums elsewhere, I did mention that it might do everybody good if the government did take a peaceful approach and not even just allow price competition, but just to simply stop violently suppressing it. And it was brought to my attention that there is some price competition in the area of childcare. In my own home, for example, we run the unlicensed daycare, and we can charge whatever we want. In fact, we do charge lower rates than what they're talking about here. I don't know how long that's going to go on, though. Maybe we will keep parity with it, but we'll see what happens. I'm ready to move on. How about you?
Certainly. I would like to talk to you this week about being a libertarian and being a parent. I didn't learn libertarianism myself until my youngest child, my son, was in his teens. Of course, it took me a while before I understood the philosophy well enough that I could embrace it comfortably in full and confidently.
How long have you been studying libertarianism?
I really only started digging into it 6 years ago.
Okay, so you're a bit years ahead of me then.
I've gone in whole hog since then. I love to tell people before I discovered libertarianism, I was a nasty little fascist, and that's still in me. I really have to battle it down, because a lot of the way people behave is what led me to believe that people are so dumb, you really need experts to kind of shepherd them around, but you can still be not really smart. But anyhow, the elitist in me still pushes me in fascist directions, and thank goodness for libertarianism that I've been able to to find out how wrong that is.
And you were asking me about my kids. Yeah, I do have two kids. They are 3 and 7.
3 and 7. So you're the 7-year-old is in school already then?
He started grade 3, yeah.
Oh, that's great. So, and you don't mind public school?
It is public school. We're exploring homeschool options. It turns out it's not quite as hard to start homeschooling here as we thought it might be. There's not much of a homeschooling community, but I guess I'm not averse to trying to start building communities, but we will see what happens.
Okay. So I take it your wife is either libertarian or libertarian sympathetic or leaning or.
She listens to my rants, and I think
Okay.
most of them get through.
Well, she's open-minded. That's great. So your kids will get your kids will probably get the full meal deal. That they'll get a good exposure to you. Anyhow, this topic caught my attention because of a lady who's been guest blogging on Radley Balko's blog. Radley writes for the Huffington Post, and he maintains a separate blog at theagitator.com. Anyhow, this woman, her name is Lenore Skenazy, and she also has a blog, which is freerangekids.wordpress.com. And Lenore became famous or notorious for a 2008 article she wrote for the New York Sun, in which she described how she left her 9-year-old son at a department store with some money, a subway map, some quarters for the payphone, and then let him get himself home using the subway and the bus. And this wasn't a surprise, surprise thing for the kid. She just hands him this stuff and says, "Okay, buddy, you're on your own." Her son had been actively campaigning to do this. Apparently, he had been working on her, saying, "Just put me somewhere and let me see if I could get home." As a result of the article, there were a pile of people who just went nuts and called her the world's worst mom. Some people advocated for her arrest or the seizure of her children, and on and on and on. But there was, conversely and happily, there were a lot of folks who thought it was great. And now there's this burgeoning movement under the phrase she coined, which is free range kids, which I really dig because I hate how infantilized the state makes us. And I'd like to cultivate some independence in the kids because in public schools are to some degree little progressive factories. They turn out little socialists in there, people who think that the government's great and all that it does. And also cultivating independence in kids, I think, makes parenting an easier thing to do. Did
Absolutely.
you get a look at any of her blog posts or get a chance to have a look at the blog?
I did take a look at it there. It's curious, though. Would you want to tell us a bit about how free range was your childhood?
I've come to look at it as horrifyingly free range. When I it was my first reflex, I think of walking to elementary school, which I did in grade one, and it was a substantial hike in my mind's eye. It was 15 to 20 minutes, and we had this was an urban area. I lived in an apartment complex, and we had a fixed path on which we were to walk, and each one of the intersections had a crossing guard, which was actually what they call was a safety patrol. And these were grade six kids. And they had a little orange, it wasn't even a vest, it was a belt, an orange belt, and then a strap that came across their chest with a little silver badge. And they would cross you when it was safe for you to cross. So we were, here we were in the hands of 11-year-olds who would cross us through these streets. We did have it seemed to me, a lot more freedom to go about, and it wasn't the end of the world, but certainly kids did get hurt on occasion. I don't know if this sort of helicoptering or nannying, constant hectoring and nannying of children is more rigid. I think if I were to send my 1-year-old, or pardon me, my grade one child to walk to the elementary school now, which is literally one block away, even has no controlled crossings except for the last two, which are over a major road. The rest are, I suppose they could stay on the sidewalk the whole way and cross one urban street. But I am sure that I would face all kinds of grief from the elementary school and my neighbors.
If you let
Just
him, if you let your kid, your grade one kid,
yeah.
walks one block.
If I were to do that, because there are sections where my child would be out of my vision and would not be under observation from one of the school agents for half a block or so, and God knows anything could happen.
So are there stories about people doing similar things and getting flagged from the school?
No, because no one would dream of that now.
Oh, it's known that this is not done?
Yeah, that's right. It isn't. No one would consider doing it. I just don't get a sense that it happens. If your kid is grade 3 or under, you're going to walk them to school or you're going to drive them to school. And it becomes kind of a conflict between the kids and the parents, of course, because the kid would like to show a little independence.
Mm-hmm.
Or certainly not be seen to be walked to school by mommy and daddy, even though they all suffer it. So there's a kind of a wink and a nod amongst all the parents that they hang back a block or so from the school, as soon as they get within sight, they'll stay back and watch their kid head on. But the idea of, for example, if I were to take my 9-year-old, which is a grade four student. If I were to go to downtown Victoria, leave him in the mall there, and then expect him to make it on his own, people would certainly be going bananas about this.
So yeah, my childhood was almost in two phases. Up until I was 8, I lived on a dairy farm, and I remember with me and my 4 older brothers and sisters going on winter adventures, and me not knowing where we were going, and I was scared sometimes. Like there's no way that my parents had any idea where we were, where we could possibly have been going, with this farm machinery and who knows what other kinds of wells and other traps in this farm wilderness. And it was interesting. Phase 2 was when we did move to Charlottetown. We moved into what we called a suburb, I guess. And yeah, similarly, I walked, I think it would have been 20 minutes or so to get to school. It was not on a major highway, but a decently busy route. And I could even have walked with my oldest brothers and sisters who went to a junior high school close by, but mm-hmm. that didn't even seem necessary. They went another shortcut, and I went along the route, and it all worked out. Like, this was me walking in grade 3 when I had siblings who were going in pretty much the same direction, and it was unnecessary for them to escort me. So I don't know if that's a sign of the changing times. Did you want to talk about Hunter from the Free Range Kids blog?
There was an incident not too long ago. A young child by the name of Hunter. He is deaf, and his name in sign language is somewhat akin to the motions a child would use if he was playing cowboys and Indians, where you stick your thumb up, extend your 4 fingers, and then you alternate your left and right hands, saying pew 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 pew. But Hunter, in order to differentiate his name from the noun Hunter, crosses his middle fingers over his index finger, and then just kind of waggles them back and forth. And this, the school to which he goes, he's only 3 years old, I think, has said that they want Hunter to change the way he signs his name, because they have a zero tolerance weapons policy, and the description of those items that are not tolerated are any items that resemble a weapon. And Hunter's crossing of his middle finger and waggling them back and forth like that, it is sufficiently threatening as far as the school administration is concerned, that they've asked him to change his name. If you can find videos of this on YouTube, mm-hmm. and what you find, of course, is this obnoxious, smarmy school administrator, who says very calmly, in that particularly smarmy and annoying fashion that only a government bureaucrat can have, that we're working, he says, we're working with the parents to arrive at the best solution for the child. This is so off-putting.
He didn't even invoke the children. He said the child.
That's precisely what he did. He said, we're working towards the best interests of the child. The presumption is that he would have any say in that at all. The notion that a school administrator should somehow have something to say to a parent about what their child's best interest is. Now, who would be the best judge of that, do you think, if not the parent? But obviously, this officious little ninny thinks that that's a function of his, and having got himself a degree in child psychology or whatever it takes to administer this school, sees himself as not only the educator and caregiver of the child, but of the parent as well.
So do you think that the administrator does not have any role to play in the safety of the children at the school?
In the safety, certainly. But this isn't what he was talking about.
Well, is the violence policy not about safety?
Well, it's certainly overreach. I think the zero tolerance policies are rather like minimum sentencing requirements. They lead you into positions that are so irrational. And I will be a little sympathetic towards the bureaucrats here. Because when they're faced with regulations like this, they're really not in a position to exercise what any of us would call good judgment. Because
so if I can even get some more context here, where was the story from?
Well, it's from the U.S. I'm sorry, I can't be any more specific than that. I don't find it in my notes here.
So then it wasn't even at the school level that this regulation had been passed. It was something above him at the board level.
That I can't say, but there are lots of variations on the zero tolerance policy for weapons. And if you follow this sort of thing, you'll find this sort of thing going on in England and the U.S., where a child will bring in something like a 2-inch plastic replica of a pistol. There was a horrible incident here in Canada where a child who had drawn a picture of a firearm in connection with her father, and it turns out the father did have a legal firearm, but the school had called the police, and this gentleman was arrested. His two children were hauled off by social services, and the wife was detained as well, while they tried to establish whether or not the child was safe, simply because she had drawn a picture. As I said, there was a legal firearm in the house. There was no suggestion. But when you're dealing with, when you have bureaucrats,
bureaucrats protecting the children.
They have nothing to gain by being reasonable.
Yep.
And that's a very big deal. You'll find this with enforcement agents. If they decided to be cool about it, be sensible about it, and something were to go awry, they would be in such profound trouble. Whereas if they're decent about it and nothing comes of it, they really don't gain anything other than, you know, a little peace of mind, or they get to relax that they were good. But when you get a zero tolerance policy in, and schools are just crazy for these things, zero tolerance for drugs, where you get you get young ladies who have cramps when they go through their menstrual cycle, and they bring Midol or something like that, or aspirin to school. If there's a zero tolerance policy, they face expulsion. And it's simply because, as I said, the bureaucrat has nothing to gain from this. So I think our kids are really done badly by with zero tolerance policies.
Yeah, and my experience is that the do-gooders in the bureaucracy tend not to make very high up. They tend not to have the stomach for the paperwork and the politic and whatnot. It's the careerists that make it up to a mid level and higher, and they tend not to worry so much about that warm feeling that they get in their bellies. If you do want to link or ground this back to Hunter here, I do wonder if this smarmy bureaucrat that you're talking about, if he did actually have the power to change, if not the regulation, then the interpretation of it. And if not, it seems like that would be the fault that was made a long time ago that made this story.
Well,
what it is.
Having voiced some sympathy for these bureaucrats, let me walk that back a little. There is no doubt in my mind that there are certain types of people who think that actions like that are justified. They think that regulations like this are important, and they think they are just the person to enforce them. So
I know this because you used to be one of them,
and because we've all had to deal with them as well. These there are people who feel they have a calling. We run into them, And they find their way into social services because they want to help people. If they're like me and they have these fascistic tendencies and think that there are people who are too dumb to decide things for themselves, then they're going to do that, go out there and do these things. And I don't doubt that many of them believe sincerely that what they're doing is the right thing to do. Yeah, they might be deceiving themselves, but I'm certain many of them believe that. So I wouldn't go so I'm willing to suggest that perhaps this obnoxious administrator was bound by his position. But on the other hand, I wouldn't entirely discount that's just the way he likes things.
I'm ready to move on to Plan B.
Plan B, yes. You're going to be rerouting a road over there on the island, is that right?
Possibly, if the government has its way, Plan B is a plan to reroute a section of the Trans-Canada Highway in Bonshaw. It's a place, I guess, to the west of Charlottetown. And this is coming up against quite a popular backlash. Everywhere I go, there are little signs and bumper stickers that say "Stop Plan B." And since I knew I was going to be talking about it on the show, I kind of steered some of my conversations with the cab toward it, and I did not get one positive response to this.
I don't find anything in the media about it that speaks well of it. That it seems opposition is universal on the island, except for your elected officials and some contractors.
I guess we'll also say my homepage for the Stop Plan B. I guess that even colors it right there. That I do get most of my information from Stop Plan B, which is at sites.google.com/site/StopPlanBBonshawPEI. If you can get all that in there,
I think I got that all written down.
I'll link to it anyhow. But it does seem to cover a whole bunch of different sections here, and just possibly a perfect storm of getting in the crowd the wrong people here. Like, you got the eminent domain people, you got the wildlife conservation people, you got the fiscally responsible people all saying, "What are you doing?" And honestly, I have no idea what they're doing. So from what I did get from the site there, or even last night, I had somebody tell me a statistic. I don't know if I should be citing unsourced statistics here, but apparently PEI only has like 3% forest coverage left on the entire island. I don't know what it was previously or how that's changing, but PEI is the most densely populated province in all of PEI, or in all of Canada. And we don't have a whole lot of forest left, so to treat a watershed callously seems like you're playing with fire there. And when they are going to be rerouting this thing, it will put a nice piece of asphalt, to my understanding, right through a piece of watershed. And there was an environmental assessment done recently, but paid for by the province. It seems like it probably slants more toward, or more in favor of the contractors than you would expect. So if you do want another pro Plan B take, you can look at the environmental assessment. It's a little bit dry, but hey, it's what they got.
Well, it doesn't strike me that the politicians have done a particularly good job of defending this. Usually you can find, at least some members of the public in favor of programs like these. But as I said, I'm not finding anything here. Now, one question I wasn't able to find an answer to was, with this rerouting of the highway, what happens to the old stretch?
I couldn't tell you exactly what would happen with it, but I've seen the relics of similar projects, and they're usually just turned into subdivisions, turned into residential areas.
I see. I
So
see.
you can start building houses and whatnot on them. There's at least two spots I can think of, one on the Trans-Canada Highway and one under it too.
I'm a little bit more concerned. I'll say, with the eminent domain concerns here, rather than the environmental concerns. Obviously, I'm opposed to eminent domain, and historically, private road and rail builders have been able to accomplish their goals without having to resort to eminent domain, simply by planning for alternate routes. So, if they want to get someone wants to get a road or a rail in from Charlottetown to Victoria, then they plot a couple of routes and start negotiating with the sellers on the routes. And the sellers are in a weaker position, because if you're a holdout on your route, then the road and rail builder has the opposition has the option of going to an alternate route. But it is an interesting dilemma. And when you have something on a place like PEI, there are limited options for building paths. There's sort of a reverse tragedy of the commons that happens, a tragedy of the anti-commons, where you get so many players involved in something that a worthy project such as a road can't take place because you've got, you know, one obstinate holdout there. You get the little old lady in her cottage who just wants to die there, and she couldn't care less how much money you give her or anything like that. And I'm sympathetic with her, and I would not like to see, pardon me, that's an understatement, I am entirely opposed to the use of eminent domain to force this woman out of her house.
Nature kind of takes care of that one, though, doesn't it? Eventually, unfortunately, she does have to die eventually, and the next person who inherits the property might not be so attached to it.
That's true, but the market also has ways of forcing people to do things against their will. And I was just wondering, on a place like PEI, if owners knew that there was no resorting to eminent domain, then if I've got a farm, then I would want to take into consideration that one day some developer may want to do something that's going to involve me and some of my neighbors. And that if he's able to come to terms with all of us, except one guy who will not give way, all of us are going to be out of, we're all going to miss on the opportunity because of this fella. And I imagine PEI farmers are just as stubborn and independent-minded as farmers everywhere, and really wouldn't care much if their neighbors were mad at them. They're going to go on and do what they do. But it's realizing that such a possibility is there, you can actually work in a sort of private version of eminent domain by establishing covenants.
Do you want to take a quick second here to explain what is eminent domain and then put in context these covenants?
Sure. For listeners who don't know, I'm a U.S. citizen, so I don't know how it works constitutionally in Canada or in PEI in particular. But in the U.S., there is a constitutional provision permitting the government to take property for public use against the will of the owners, provided they supply fair compensation. Now, of course, unfortunately, that's been run amok in the U.S., and there was a terrible instance very recently called Kelo versus New London, which made its way to the Supreme Court in the U.S., where the municipality of New London, Connecticut, I think it was, wanted to seize the property of a woman named Susan Kelo in order to sell it to, I believe it was Pfizer Pharmaceuticals, who were going to put up a factory in there. Susan Kelo didn't want to give it up. Pfizer went to the government of New London and said, look, seize her property, compensate her for it, sell it to us, we'll put up this factory, and you get more taxes. This is a public good. It provides a public benefit. And horrifyingly, not only did the New London government agree with this argument, so did the U.S. Supreme Court. And this has set off a firestorm in the United States. And there are horrific incidents all over the U.S. and some in Canada as well, of the state declaring areas blighted and forcing their sale. And typically, when a person thinks of the government use of eminent domain, it would be for things such as a military base or road or railway, but certainly not to hand over to a pharmaceutical company. Here in the case of Plan B, we have a more originalist use of the intent of eminent domain, which is to seize property from holdouts, provide them with fair compensation. I'm not certain who determines what that is, or if you can actually even do that, if it's possible for the state to determine what fair compensation is.
Again, every property has an assessment on it in order to collect taxes on it.
I see what you mean. Well, in this case, when a road goes through a farm or something like that, they often don't buy the whole farm. They'll just buy a portion of it and then provide a covenant or a right of way for the farmer to get from one side from his property on one side of the road to his property on the other side. You'll find that all over British Columbia. As I said, in this case, you can see that for private citizens who would want to put themselves in a position where road, and not just road builders, but this shows the superiority of the market. In the case of Kelo versus New London, it's quite clearly immoral and evil for the state to seize private property from one person and hand it over to another private agent. But in the market, if you set up if, for example, Suzette Kelo had a covenant or was part of a covenant with all her neighbors in that area, had she decided that she didn't want to sell for the purpose of this private factory being set up, then her neighbors could have used that covenant to force her to sell to a private institution. And that would have been all good. She would have been signed to that covenant. It would have been something she had entered voluntarily when she purchased the property. So by taking the notion of eminent domain away from the coercive state and putting in the hands of private property owners, you actually increase its ability. And that's all I had to say about that. You'll get people who are saying, well, how are you going to these things past holdouts and things like that? But in the absence of eminent domain, I think you would see a rise of covenants like that. Another issue I was concerned with about this is federal involvement. The articles I've read suggest that half the money is coming from the feds. Do I remember that correctly?
I couldn't give you an estimate of how much, but I do know there is federal money coming into it. But it is part of the Trans-Canada Highway, so that does fall under federal jurisdiction, to my understanding, anyhow.
Probably part of what's driving the bureaucracy there to do this project, because that federal money, they can't get that money unless they reroute this highway. Otherwise, and that money is an opportunity to farm votes. It's a way to hand out privileges to people, and so that could be, to a large extent, what's driving them. But federal funding is a charade. This notion that PEI is going to be getting federal money, well, where's that federal money coming from?
I have heard people refer to federal money as free money.
Free money, well.
By the same extent, you could say any money that comes from government is free money, even if it's municipal. It's from your neighbor. Maybe your neighbor's on the other side of the street or the other side of the country, but yeah, it does have to come from somebody.
And to say, where is it coming from? Because if you think it's coming from me here on Vancouver Island, I want to wake you up to something. We have a very important bridge here that's being rebuilt, and we're getting federal money too. And guess where that's coming from? Charlottetown, I'll bet. It's a shell game. You're either getting money from people who didn't want to give it to you. You know, if PEI is actually getting money from Vancouver Island via the feds, you're either getting money from people who didn't want to give it to you, or you're going to get back more or less what you put in yourself. And the former, if you're getting money from me that I don't want to give to you, that's theft. It's just wrong. And if you're only getting back the money or less money than you put in, then that's pointless. You should be left with your own money. And you can bet that whoever's using the power to distribute that money, they're doing it in a fashion that benefits themselves.
I think I'd like to move on here just after I put in one little note, which is that when all this money gets aggregated and spent, there's a tiny chance that there will be value added to it from government, but there's no way to know that because of the lack of market signals. There's no profit to be made, and so we just can't know if what it's spent on is more valuable than the other things that it could have been spent on.
That's exactly right. When I mentioned earlier that I wanted to discuss Hayek's conceit.
if you can do this quickly, I'd really like to get on to your the last topic that you mentioned too.
Well, on the points of the environmental concerns, there are environmental concerns, but it's not just the ones that are voiced by the opponents of the project. It's quite possible that there is too much time, money, and effort going to be spent on environmental protection. It's difficult to determine because the chief player in this is the government, and they're spending money that's not theirs on something for somebody else. If I'm able to take money from one stranger and then I have to spend it on something for another stranger, then I'm not going to be too concerned about whether or not the thing I'm buying is good value. And it's the same thing for politicians. It's just as likely that they're going to spend too many resources on environmental concerns, which is going to leave fewer resources for things that may be more important, such as, I don't know, wages for daycare workers or something.
Yeah, I always bring it full circle, don't you? All right, do you want to move on? I was really interested in this story that you brought up.
This wasn't a plan. This wasn't one of the topics we had planned, so I don't have a whole lot of information on it, but I understood a couple days ago that Canada has withdrawn its Iranian ambassadors from Iran. If Iran hasn't already ejected or withdrawn its ambassadors from Canada, then Canada has also rejected them, kicked them out. So we've got embassy closures there. When I first heard that, I thought, well, that's swell. I have serious reservations about whether or not one of the core functions of a federal government should be interacting with other federal governments. I don't know if you jump in any time if you have an opinion on this. I'll just ramble a little bit.
Well, I'll give you a quick take on it, a counter take on it, if you want me to jump in here, which is if, assuming that the nation of Canada is going to exist, assuming there's going to be me paying for an army that's going to protect me, and assuming there's something similar going on in Iran, then I don't know it's a bad idea to have the heads of those armies talking to each other so that they don't do stupid things and start shooting for no reason.
Yeah, so I guess the whole thing pushes me further towards my anarchic side, which is that I have no libertarian defense of national defense being supplied through coercive means. And in the absence of that, it's difficult for me to imagine the kind of agent that would be talking to other agencies. So to work a little off what you've said, even acknowledging that Canada would have a coercively supplied national defense, I still don't see what need there is for one government to be working with another government to have diplomatic ties with them. The only relations there should be between two states are peaceful, voluntary interactions. The only people who should be working with Iran are people who have business with Iran. Now, Canada,
so you're also talking it should be peaceful, voluntary, and private. I think a lot of what is going on, or what happens between states, a lot of it is bound up in trade, and a lot of people have this, what I view as a wacky notion, as for some reason, free trade agreements have to be bilateral. That for some reason, in order for me to let you sell your goods here and benefit my people, you have to do the same thing in your country.
That's fine.
It seems like a wacky notion that to not think that giving the people in my country the option to buy goods wherever they want, without tariffs and trades and quotas, without the other country doing the same thing. To me, that seems a little wacky. And so then in order to get these bilateral trade agreements all built up, then it often does take, the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Pact or something. I think that's
the partnership.
Partnership. I think that's in its third year of negotiation now, and they're still writing drafts and whatnot. So these things do take layers of bureaucracy and time and communication between states to finally hammer these out.
They do if you think that the state has to be the agency to do that. But in fact, the only reason that we have trade agreements are because we have governmental state, we have governmental international interactions. The only thing that's required for a trade agreement is for Canada to simply eliminate all trade barriers of every sort unilaterally, no matter what any other country does, what they're willing to sell us, what they're willing to buy from us. The best position for Canada is to simply remove all barriers of any sort to trade. Now, as far as this, I think the same thing comes into play in defense. Okay, so if you're the kind of libertarian who says that the state has a justifiable defense, a justifiable monopoly on defense, and therefore would supply national defense, this still doesn't mean that we have to involve, that the governments have to be communicating with each other. There's still tremendous amounts of information that flow back and forth over the private sector, probably more so when the state is not involved. When you have the coercive state involved in international negotiations, you're going to wind up with the same kind of problems with international relations that you wind up with in international trade. So the best thing, the best policy you can do, I think, in national defense as well as in trade, is to tend to your own business. Do what you yourself are supposed to be doing. Behave properly and prepare to defend yourself. And I think that would be sufficient. Other than that, I think having ambassadors from our country to Canada and from our country to Iran and from Iran into Canada presents an opportunity for misbehavior. And I think I think the costs of having diplomatic ties I suspect, because I'm not an expert in this, but I would suspect that having government-to-government diplomatic ties causes a great deal more harm than it prevents.
I think the embassies might even have inadvertently shown that they agreed with you, since in this ramp-up toward war is when you would think they would need these ambassadors the most, and yet that's when they kick them out.
Yeah, there's almost certainly some kind of message there. And on the topic of this kind of saber rattling towards Iran in general, I think there's this is a horrible thing going on. The demographics in Iran, most Canadians are probably not aware of this, but Iran is a very, very young country. And the generation coming up now, the youngest generation, are cut from a whole different cloth. They're far more secular. They're far more interconnected. Iran is probably a powder keg, and it will work more against Western interests, I think, than aggressing against Iran. It's the kind of thing that allows the existing power elite to turn to the population and say, see how under attack we are, see how aggressive they are towards us, see how unreasonable they are towards us, and you see how important it is that you accept these restrictions we put on you. I think there's a tremendous opportunity here being missed out to bring Iran away from its status as this kind of pariah state and into the international community simply by and in this light, I think that's terrific then that diplomatic ties have been broken. Now, if we could just eliminate all the trade barriers and start doing business with Iran, then I believe that the West could, for lack of a better metaphor, trade Iran into submission. Submission's a pretty brutal term, but I think you get what I mean. We can do business with Iran and civilize them. That's a term. Yeah.
Fine common ground.
Let me just stop there and assume everybody gets the idea.
I'm ready to, unless you want to stick your foot in your mouth anymore before we wrap up.
I've got a mouthful.
All right, so my name is Ashley Johnson. I blog at libertypei.blogspot.ca from Charlottetown, Prince Edward Island. And Dave, where are you?
I am here on Vancouver Island, where I and my fellow members of the Victoria Libertarian Book Club blog at libertarianbookclub.com. Please come by and visit, comment on this episode or whatever post you happen to be looking at. We'd love to hear from you.
Yep, if you have any feedback, find us, track us down. If you have any ideas about ways to involve the community in this podcast, we're hungry for ideas. Thanks a lot. Have a good day.